Sick Enough, Chapter 6, Starting to Eat Again. Case Taylor. Taylor is a 26-year-old, cisgender, East Asian American female graduate student with anorexia nervosa restricting subtype. Her eating disorder started when she was 12, and she went through partial hospitalization care at the time and then had an outpatient team. By high school, she felt confident in her recovery. Throughout college, she maintained a somewhat low weight and grew increasingly rigid about her food intake and exercise habits. Now in graduate school, like the academic pressures in addition to a part-time job have increased her stress and anxiety, and in response, she engages in a lot of judgmental and critical self-talk. Her caloric intake falls slowly over time as food rules regain their power. Her weight remains stable, which is confusing and rather frustrating for her. As Taylor's concentration and energy decrease, and she isolates more as so not to eat socially, her family becomes concerned. Her parents and best friend compassionately share that they see her struggling with her anorexia nervosa again. Taylor tries to brush them off, noting that her weight is fine, so she's not sick enough to merit their concern. She is embarrassed and ashamed of attracting their attention when she'd rather just be invisible at this point. Her loved ones aren't deterred, having seen this before. They say it's not about how she looks, it's about how she's managing her emotions through food restriction again. They see the difference when she's restricting because she's withdrawn, snappy, rigid, and unhappy. They ask her to engage an outpatient eating disorder team again and take care of herself. In her heart, Taylor is ready to work on recovery. She doesn't like the person she becomes when her anorexia nervosa is in charge. Not only does she push her loved ones away, but also studying takes 3 times longer as her brain lacks concentration and memory. However, she's plagued by the fear that she's permanently ruined her metabolism. She knows when she was 12, she had to eat over 3,000 calories a day to restore weight slowly, but she's more than twice that age now. She worries that if she starts eating more again, that she'll never be able to stop. She anxiously imagines a dietitian putting her on a meal plan that will raise her body weight quickly and yet still not satisfy her hunger. She's fearful that her body will get better faster than her soul, and that all too quickly, no one will take her emotional needs seriously. Nevertheless, Taylor finds a therapist, dietitian, and doctor who all specialize in eating disorders, and she shares her fears. Background. Reintroducing nutrition is key to the eating disorder recovery process in malnourished patients of all sizes and shapes. All the therapy in the world will not help unless the patient is also eating enough calories to close the energy deficit. For some patients, this process has nothing to do with weight and everything to do with learning how to eat satisfying, energizing meals at regular intervals throughout the day, free from worries about food group restrictions. For other patients, it involves learning to address their needs holistically so that binging on and purging foods does not become a numbing proxy for feeling and managing emotions. And for others, it involves a painstaking process of transforming from a starved, depleted body to a vibrant, stronger body. A registered dietitian with expertise in eating disorders is a vital asset in the nutritional rehabilitation process. You can identify such a dietitian by the Certified Eating Disorders Registration Dietitian Designation, CEDRD, a credential overseen by the International Association of Eating Disorder Professionals, IAEDP, which requires documentation of extensive eating disorder experience, ongoing learning, and contribution to the field. Therapists, nurses, doctors, and other specialists can also qualify for the CEDS designation. In the case of dietitians who have not yet gotten their CEDRD, you can get a sense of their experience in and commitment to the field by looking at their website and interviewing them. Eating disorder dietitians will not advise weight loss tips, nor espouse pseudoscientific claims that sugar is evil, nor endorse any fad diet scheme. While staying within scope of practice, they will nonetheless have a compassionate, highly informed awareness of mental illness and be supportive motivators. Eating disorder dietitians are responsive to and not overwhelmed by eating disorder fears and anxieties. The concepts discussed in this chapter are broadly applicable to malnourished individuals across the weight spectrum, although the risk for refeeding syndrome appears to apply more to those at a lower body weight. The hypermetabolism of nutritional rehabilitation. By now, you know that restriction of calories does indeed slow the metabolism. Let me try that again. By now, you know that restriction of calories does indeed slow the metabolism. The degree to which it slows is dependent upon the degree of restriction and the person's genetic variability. I know patients who lose absolutely no weight despite severe caloric restriction because their metabolism slows to defend their body weight vigorously. I also know patients who don't quite consume their usual 300 calorie a day maintenance meal plan for a day or two and drop weight, particularly practically overnight. This is written in the genetics for the most part. Currently, the scientific eating disorder community has encouraged people to use the term nutritional rehabilitation rather than refeeding. I think this is reasonable because the former term is both more scientifically specific and also somewhat less paternalistic than the latter term. However, there will be times in this chapter when I use them interchangeably, as the word refeeding remains commonly used. What many people do not know is that the act of nutritionally rehabilitating and restoring weight from malnourishment can take a remarkably large number of calories. As the cave person brain switches from hibernation, caloric conservation mode, to rebuild the body mode, the metabolism speeds up quickly. The same person who was maintaining weight at 800 calories a day after weeks or months of restriction now needs 3 weeks into refeeding to consume 3,500 calories a day to restore just 2 pounds of body weight a week. We still don't know why or how this happens. The hypermetabolic state that occurs almost universally in patients who begin again to take in energy, is one of the last black boxes physiologically. Where do the extra calories go? Why do some patients need up to 5,000 calories a day for slow, steady weight restoration? The jury is still out. What we do know is that hypermetabolic state is a reality for almost all patients, although the degree varies by person. Unless one knows this, recovery at home without a supportive team is impossible. Absolutely no one with anorexia nervosa would believe on their own that they need to eat until painfully full just to start to restore weight slowly. Not with a disease that fears an extra lick of frozen yogurt might cause to them calamitous weight gain. What this means is that the nutritional rehabilitation process early on is almost never intuitive, but rather prescriptive. Because eating disorders are mental illnesses, patients' intuitions about food are already going to be skewed. In addition, refeeding takes place, at least initially, in a body that has been slowed to hibernation levels by starvation. Bellies get full after a few bites. Bloating, constipation, reflux, and body image distortions can make the first weeks and even months of this process a physical and emotional street fight. Families thrilled to see their loved ones finally making progress in recovery will help best if they show consistent compassion for how difficult the process actually is. Some individuals receive the incorrect recommendation from online resources, not expert dietitians, to consume extremely high-calorie meal plans almost indefinitely for months or years as the body weight rises well past a prior individualized set point. They are told that commitment to this strategy will result in future healing and wellness as long as they keep force feeding. This is unscientific and never indicated. Eating enough food heals the metabolism slowed by caloric restriction. However, if an individual starts to restrict again, their metabolism will once again fall. In my long career in this field, I have seen patients of all different sizes, shapes, ages, genders, races, abilities, and ethnicities become hypermetabolic during refeeding. When I discuss this, my patient's disbelief is moderated by a spark of hope that perhaps, after all, they're not the one human in history whose metabolism is indeed permanently slowed. The refeeding syndrome, phosphorus and edema. This leads us to the first critical medical complication of nutritional rehabilitation, the refeeding syndrome. The refeeding syndrome describes the potentially deadly development of low phosphorus and other electrolyte levels in the blood and fluid shifts into body tissues that can occur when a starved person begins to take in nutrition. In the starved state, a person breaks down muscle and fat to create glucose, as I described in Chapter 4. Despite normal electrolyte levels in the blood, however, overall body stores of electrolytes may be low, as the body has mined electrolyte stores from body tissues in order to have access to normal levels in the bloodstream. Insulin levels start out very low during caloric restriction because insufficient carbohydrates are being consumed. When patients begin to eat more, insulin levels shoot up in order to drive life-saving glucose into hungry cells. Insulin also pushes electrolytes into cells, particularly phosphorus. This makes sense as phosphorus is one of the key electrolytes in cellular respiration, the process by which cells take in nutrients and turn them into energy to fuel the cell's function. With phosphorus moving out of the bloodstream into cells and also being used as cells become more energetic again, the blood levels of phosphorus can drop. High insulin levels can also cause the kidneys to retain salt and water rather than excreting those as normal. As a result, fluid retention, called edema, can develop from the toes all the way up to the lungs. Low phosphorus levels can cause muscle weakness and breakdown, including weakness in breathing muscles and heart muscle, as well as seizures, breakdown of red blood cells, and many other serious problems. The full-blown refeeding syndrome refers to catastrophically low levels of phosphorus and/or dangerous edema that occurs in patients taking in nutrition after having been in a starved state. This is not limited to those with eating disorders and can occur in individuals who are homeless, have alcohol or drug dependency, have been in a serious accident, and haven't yet been fed in the hospital, and who have experienced severe burns, among others. The full-blown refeeding syndrome only occurs in patients whose nutritional rehabilitation process has not been properly overseen medically. It is entirely preventable. First, practitioners need to know that the refeeding syndrome exists. And second, they need to monitor blood phosphorus levels and other electrolytes closely during the nutritional rehabilitation process. Phosphorus levels that start to drop can be identified and reminded through phosphorus supplementation. Low phosphorus levels are properly called refeeding, hypophosphatemia. Refeeding syndrome is only diagnosed when phosphorus levels get low enough for long enough to cause physiologic harm. The prevalence of full-blown refeeding syndrome in an expert setting is fleetingly low. Even among the most medically compromised patients, refeeding hypophosphatemia only occurs in 30 to 40%. Identified quickly, these patients can be prescribed appropriate phosphorus supplementation either by mouth or, in extreme cases, through their veins as well. This swift diagnosis and treatment prevents the refeeding syndrome. Refeeding edema, meaning the retention of salt and water, can range in severity from triggering, as patients look in shock at swollen feet, ankles, and tummies, to dangerous. Fluid-saturated tissues can make the overlying skin fragile and liable to breakdowns, splitting, or forming an ulcer. Once again, it is exceptionally rare in an expert setting for a patient to develop fluid retention in the lungs as a result of refeeding edema. This would constitute full-blown refeeding syndrome. Breathing complications can occur when a very underweight patient has weak breathing muscles, develops heart muscle weakness from underweight or another cause, called congestive heart failure, or fails to receive proper management for hyperphosphatemia. Low albumin levels, a protein synthesized by the liver and discussed in Chapter 4, predict edema formation. When a patient develops a low albumin level, I set expectations with them about the likelihood of their developing refeeding edema. I reassure them about the transient but scary body changes that will likely occur and set up a plan to manage and minimize the edema. Refeeding edema is different from rebound edema that occurs due to stopping purging, which I review in Chapter 9. Edema is never a sign of healing, despite this myth being perpetuated in certain circles. It may, however, be inevitable for a matter of a few weeks and no more during the renourishment process. Management includes keeping legs elevated when seated, using compression stockings during the day if tolerated, decreasing the carbohydrate fraction in the meal plan to around 40% to reduce insulin levels, and patiently waiting for the edema to resolve. Diuretics should only be used if the skin is at risk. Diuretics should only be used if the skin is at risk from breakdown due to the degree of edema, and then for as short an amount of time as possible. So, with refeeding hypophosphatemia, constituting the most dangerous medical complication of the nutritional rehabilitation process. What can we do to prevent it? Who gets it? We don't know all the answers to these questions, but we do know a lot. Study after study has shown that low body weight is one of the most important independent risk factors for refeeding complications. Risks for refeeding hypophosphatemia include prolonged periods of undernourishment, rapid and significant weight loss, congruent medical problems like cancer or infections, and electrolytes levels that are abnormal even before refeeding begins. Studies have shown that certain other lab parameters, such as low parabellum levels in the blood, can independently predict higher rates of refeeding hypophosphatemia in hospitalized patients. We used to think that starting calories very slowly in starving patients would prevent refeeding complications. As a result, in my early years in the field, we would start patients out on a meal plan of only 800 or 1,000 calories a day. It turns out we were wrong. All we were doing was causing the underfeeding syndrome. The underfeeding syndrome refers to initiating calories at too low a level in someone who has been starving. Recent studies have clearly shown that when starved patients don't start on high enough calories, their weight continues to drop, their organ systems continue to suffer, and their cognitive abilities remain rigid and anxious. In fact, we now know that the risks of underfeeding syndrome are greater and more common than the refeeding syndrome. Excellent studies show that starting calories at 1600 a day or higher, even in very underweight, medically compromised patients, is safe from the perspective of phosphorus levels. This holds true for individuals of all ages, from adults to adolescents. In the latter population, some centers recommend starting calories as high as 2500 a day. This message has been slow to permeate the eating disorder community in both outpatient and residential settings. Providers are still starting calories too low for patients worried about the refeeding syndrome. In part, this is because patients may not have access to a doctor who will readily check phosphorus levels once or twice a week as directed by their dietitian. However, starting calories much higher than in the past compromises the evidence-based standard of care. I can hear the chorus of anxious patients telling me, "Dr. G, that is way too much food." I assure each and every patient that no matter what they were eating in their disorder, their brilliant caveperson brain will rev up its metabolism when exposed to adequate food. I teach them that in the first 2 weeks of refeeding, their metabolism is likely to outpace even my prescribed caloric increases, and they might actually lose weight. I have watched this process occur countless times in both the inpatient hospital and outpatient settings. Many patients with anorexia nervosa become convinced at some point during nutritional rehabilitation that they have gained 10 pounds overnight. I respond with compassion, data, and an attempt to participate in internalized size stigma. How painful it is that your mental illness is causing such distortions. I know that makes this process hard. However, your body is extraordinary and knows just what to do. Every bite of food is actually healing your body. Amazingly, within weeks to months of adequate caloric intake, even before an underweight individual may have reached their target weight, the body's cells and organs are functioning properly. Starting to renourish. Let's turn to the details of nutritional rehabilitation, both in the outpatient and in the inpatient hospital settings. I always work in conjunction with expert dietitians around the country, and I've been lucky enough to learn from some of the best over the years. So while I may establish the starting caloric levels with my patients, I rely on their dietitian to create and oversee the meal plan itself. In the outpatient setting, patients should start calories at a minimum of 1600 a day. The macronutrient balance should contain approximately 50% of calories from carbohydrates, 30% from protein, and 20% from fat. Calories in an outpatient setting can be increased by around 500 every week. Increasing more quickly is safe, but may be hard for a patient who sees their team members only once a week. Calories should be raised until the patient is consistently restoring 1 to 2 pounds a week of non-edemus weight in an outpatient setting. In my experience, refeeding edema is less common in the outpatient setting than the inpatient. Typically, for outpatients, a phosphorus level should be checked with a basic metabolic panel of blood work once a week, and phosphorus supplementation should be started if the phosphorus levels drop below 3 milligram DL. Multiple oral preparations exist, most by prescription, and they can be taken 3 times a day until the next blood draw, at which point the dose can be altered. The side effect of taking phosphorus can be mild nausea or looser stools, so patients should be prepared to ease back on their bowel regimen while on phosphorus. Food options to manage gastroparesis. Let's talk about the nutritional management of gastroparesis. The slowed stomach emptying introduced in Chapter 2 that can pose such challenges during early nutritional rehabilitation. It turns out that when digestion is slowed due to starvation, high fiber foods worsen fullness and belly distension. Many patients with restrictive eating have lists of safe foods that feel acceptable to eat and a list of fear foods. Safe and fear foods may vary widely among different individuals, and oftentimes, fiber-containing foods rank among many patients' safest foods. Nonetheless, a low-fiber diet is best for the first 4 to 6 weeks of nutritional rehabilitation. This may be the only time a doctor urges a patient to eat almost no fruits and vegetables. In addition to their fiber content, vegetables have few calories in them. With limited gastric real estate, we have to make sure every bite is as dense, nutritious, and caloric as possible. I compassionately remind my patients that these challenges are why I always work as a team with a therapist and dietitian so that all three of us can give the patients lots of support. Liquids and semi-solids move through a slowed stomach more easily than solids. For the first few weeks of nutritional rehabilitation, to minimize belly discomfort, I recommend that the patient and their dietitian make a meal plan that's at least 30% liquid semi-solid. That could mean yogurts, chocolate milk, my favorite, ice creams, etc. This recommendation is harder on those who are dairy allergic or intolerant, but there are still ways to accomplish it. Traditionally, it's known that higher fat content in the diet worsens gastroparesis. However, I draw the line at following this for those with eating disorders. For one, There's often already such nutritional fat phobia that I'm not going to contribute to that with a recommendation to follow a low-fat diet. Second, my clinical experience of working with patients with severe gastroparesis tells me that eating low fiber and more liquid and calorie-dense food is far more important than eating low-fat food. And third, fat is a vital nutrient in the nutritional rehabilitation process. In both the outpatient and inpatient settings, patients can struggle with fullness and abdominal discomfort as their calories get higher. I've had many patients tell me, "Dr. G, I just cannot increase to 3,000 calories a day. I'm too full as it is at 2,600 a day." I am sympathetic to the profound discomfort of refeeding. However, when the weight restoration process has plateaued because of a high metabolism, they must keep pushing up on calories. I pose the following question. Are they choosing to eat relatively safe foods to get the 2,600 calories a day? That may mean pretty large volume meals that will contribute to painful fullness. While the prescribed caloric increase is non-negotiable, the patient can control how they take in those calories. If they have to eat a meal with a certain number of calories in it, that could be consumed as 16 bowls of very safe food, or as one dense peanut butter and jelly sandwich and a glass of whole fat chocolate milk. In the first case, the belly will be incredibly uncomfortable, but the eating disorder will feel safer. In the latter, the belly will be more content, but the eating disorder might be uncomfortable. Volume-neutral options to increase calories include adding more peanut butter to a sandwich, drinking juice or milk instead of water, or non-caloric beverages, increasing the fat content in yogurts, adding some more fats like cream cheese to bagels, or the use of high-calorie liquid supplements. Generally, because gastroparesis can become dangerous, I urge patients to choose the lower volume, calorie-dense meal plan. It's generally better to eat six smaller meals than three larger ones when it comes to gastroparesis. The smaller volume the stomach has to empty, the better. Nasogastric tubes and starting care in a hospital setting. Patients who enter medical hospitals that do not specialize in eating disorders often have a very negative experience with nutrition. Trays get delivered to the room with no supervision. Bathrooms are unmonitored for purging, and less than helpful commentary about body size and shape is shared by well-meaning hospital staff. But let's face it, plenty of patients with eating disorders end up in an inexpert medical setting, and for whatever reason, it's not an option to transfer to a center of excellence. In that case, I make the following recommendations. Since calories must be non-negotiable, patients should be asked if they wish to consume them orally or by tube feeding. Some patients prefer the latter because tube feeds medicalize the process. Without highly supportive mental health professionals around, tube feeding might be the most patients can commit to until they have reached an eating disorder treatment program. If they choose oral calories, the hospital staff, often with support of the family, have to provide a 1,600-calorie meal plan and inform patients that they either need to complete 100% or drink a nutritional supplement to get to 100%. Within 24 hours, a patient who chooses to eat food but cannot or does not achieve this should receive a nasogastric feeding tube. In patients under 18 years old, the parents can make this decision and enforce it. In adults, tube refusal and food refusal should prompt hospitals and family members to increase the pressure to transfer to a center of expertise as quickly as possible. I have seen patients sit in excellent university hospitals for weeks, refusing food, failing to progress, and remaining too sick for a residential program. When transferred to a highly expert hospital setting, these same individuals suddenly make progress nutritionally, heal organ damage and get stronger, and are rapidly able to proceed in their recovery journey. When a hospitalized patient does receive a nasogastric feeding tube, low-fiber tube feeds should be used. Round-the-clock caloric provision diminishes the risk of hypoglycemia and reduces the volume per hour that is introduced into the stomach. Hospital staff are often accustomed to starting tube feeds on post-surgical patients at rates that are far too low for someone with an eating disorder. A typical starting tube feeding rate for nutritional rehabilitation might be around 60 milliliters an hour, over 22 hours a day. That can sound like a lot to nursing staff and doctors. I respectfully remind them that this is only 2 ounces an hour. An infant can manage more than that when drinking from a bottle or nursing. A medium latte has 512 milliliters in it, and most people don't sip at one of those over 8 hours. If a patient with an eating disorder receives tube feeding at the slow rate of a post-surgical patient, time will be wasted and organ failure will progress. In the hospital setting, acuity of illness requires that calories be stepped up faster to avoid the underfeeding syndrome. Calories should be increased by 400 every 3 days until the patient is gaining 2 to 3 pounds a week. Electrolytes should be checked depending on admission levels, anywhere from daily to once a week, replacing phosphorus when it falls below 3 mg/dL. Ideally, once the brain gets a little nourished, the patient will agree to start eating food again, and tube feeds can be tapered off. In eating disorder programs, tube feeding can be used productively for overnight calories when the meal plan has become burdensomely high or to catch up on calories missed during the day. A nasogastric tube can remain in place for up to 6 weeks with good care. Risks include sinus infection, reflux, aspiration pneumonia, and vocal cord irritation or injury. More permanent feeding tubes also exist, inserted through the abdominal wall and terminating in the stomach or in the small intestine. Surgical feeding tubes. These more permanent tubes are called percutaneous endoscopic gastrostomy, PEG, or percutaneous endoscopic jejunostom, PEG tubes. They can be placed by a surgeon, interventional radiologist, or gastroenterologist. PEG tubes terminate in the stomach, while PEJ tubes terminate in the jejunum, which is part of the small intestine. They are used in many different patient populations, not just in patients with eating disorders. PEG tubes should only be used when there are significant medical impediments to receiving nutrition by any other means. PEG tubes should never be placed just because someone will not take in adequate oral nutrition. The fact is, nearly all patients with eating disorders already have a functional tube in their stomach. It's called their esophagus. If patients will not take in adequate calories by mouth because of their severe mental illness, they will also restrict tube feeds. I understand the magical thinking that patients and families can have in thinking that just getting a tube in will permit adequate caloric intake. However, I have witnessed time and time again that patients with a PEG will either underdose their tube feedings, dilute the feeds with water to get in fewer calories, or sabotage the tube itself. Plus, surgical feeding tubes aren't without risks. Their placement can be quite complicated with intense pain and nausea that in any clinical experience lasts longer than in those without an eating disorder. Removing a PEG before it is healed, 6 to 8 weeks after placement, can cause catastrophic abdominal infections. Thus, placing a PEG in a patient with a history of impulsive actions is contradicted. Ultimately, surgical feeding tubes should be reserved for patients who truly cannot take in nourishment by mouth. A history of severe and persistent difficulty swallowing, medical inability to keep food in the stomach due to intractable vomiting, or a complete obstruction due to SMA syndrome are all reasonable indications for a percutaneous tube. Total parenteral nutrition. Total parenteral nutrition, TPN, refers to nutrition administered via a deep vein, a central line or peripherally inserted central catheter, PICC line, is placed and a dietitian or doctor offers a bag of nutrition that can be infused right into the bloodstream. Whenever possible, it is always preferable to use the gut for nutrition rather than the bloodstream. As long as the intestine works even a little bit, I recommend using food or liquid supplements. TPN carries several major medical risks. One, the placement of the central catheter can cause a lung to deflate, called pneumothorax. Two, a bag of pure nourishment straight into the blood doesn't only nourish the patient, it can also nourish bacteria. TPN, used over time, represents a when, not an if, when it comes to serious bloodstream infections, which may prove deadly. TPN can be used for a matter of weeks if someone is absolutely unable to take food by mouth due to GI problems that are related to underweight, such as severe gastroparesis or SMA syndrome, and if they cannot, for whatever reason, tolerate a feeding tube through the nose. Once needed body weight is restored, however, the gut should again be used. Micronutrients, thiamine and zinc. There are a several number of vitamins and minerals that are truly evidence-based to give during nutritional supplementation. The most important of these is thiamine, or B1 vitamin. Thiamine helps several enzymes vital to metabolism, and it is most needed during times of high metabolic rate and glucose intake. Acute thiamine insufficiency, especially during early refeeding, can cause a distinct delirium syndrome categorized by the combination of confusion, staggering gait, and eye problems. This is called Wernicke's encephalopathy. Paleopathy. Diagnosed predominantly in individuals with severe alcoholism and malnutrition, it has also been described in patients with anorexia nervosa and is considered a risk during refeeding. While Wernicke's encephalopathy encephalopathy can be reversed with thiamine administration. If left untreated, it can progress to Korsakoff's amnésic syndrome. Korsakoff's syndrome causes irreversible amnesia and confabulation, making things up and believing they are true. The administration of 200 milligrams of oral thiamine daily for at least 10 days is appropriate in nutritional rehabilitation of all malnourished patients, not just those with anorexia nervosa. Zinc is a micronutrient whose deficiency in chronic malnutrition has been established by what's called level B evidence. That means that there's at least one good study or several studies with limitations that have reached this conclusion. Zinc is involved in over 300 human enzymes. Its deficiency, ranging from mild to severe, is associated with numerous findings: severe height restriction, skin and hair fragility, poor immune state, low testosterone, anemia, cognitive decline, and others. There is no simple, cheap test either for zinc or thiamine deficiency. Because zinc is inexpensive and harmless, I tend to recommend a course of it at the beginning of refeeding for all of my outpatients, particularly those with complaints of poor hair and skin quality. I prefer my patients to take zinc as a lozenge that absorbs through the cheek. I recommend 15 milligram zinc gluconate lozenges once a day or a month or two. Lozenges. Got High dose zinc administration chronically can interfere with copper absorption and should thus be avoided. Target weight range. All this talk of nutritional rehabilitation brings me to the topic of the target weight range. This subject has nothing to do with weight loss in those with larger bodies and only refers to those who are underweight. Most patients with anorexia nervosa dread and fear gaining weight. Therefore, the subject of how much weight is my team going to make me gain is of paramount interest and worry. Ultimately, I always make this decision in conjunction with my parents, with my patient's therapist, dietitian, and optimally with the patients themselves. It's not a topic that should even be discussed until well into the refeeding process. With a starved, paranoid cave person brain and a critical fear of even 1 pound of weight gain, no one should be tormented early in recovery by the idea of some number range they are supposed to reach, weeks or months hence. However, at some point, it's reasonable to know that one is what one is aiming for. I remind my patients that I can't land a helicopter on a dime. That is, they might say, "Okay, Dr. G, I'm okay with weighing X weight, but not an ounce more." I explain to them that everyone's weight varies naturally and that a weight goal is always a range. I urge them never to get on a scale again. Really, no one needs to, because that is something that their team can manage for them. The act itself of getting on a scale can be triggering, and depending on the stability of their recovery, a single moment on the scale can undo weeks of productive work. Once weight restoration is complete and the patient has maintained a stable weight for a satisfactory period of time, as far as I'm concerned, they never need to be weighed again. Ultimately, I keep in mind several factors when estimating an initial goal weight range: the patient's height, childhood growth charts, were they in the 20th percentile or the 90th percentile throughout childhood, pre-eating disorder weight range, and familial body type. I also think it is useful to know the weight where my female patients last had normal menstrual periods or were able to get pregnant unassisted, or my male patients notice a significant decrease in sex drive and function. Estimating a target weight range for patients forces practitioners to examine their own internalized weight stigma. Some patients' goal weight ranges lie in higher body weights. I never want to ally with their eating disorder or society's fat phobia by rejecting or resisting this fact. It is possible to know an individual patient's body type when they are emancipated. Individuals who develop their eating disorder in their teens may recollect a pre-eating disordered weight that they hold onto as a target for the future. However, they may not be finished growing yet, and that target may be far too low. Depending on the patient, their emotional state, medical problems, and duration of illness, I don't always feel the need to restore patients to their target weight in a linear fashion. Some individuals, in all of my adolescents, are best served getting right to their target weight, restoring steadily the whole time and nourishing their brain and bones without delay. Others who might have experienced many rounds of residential treatment with variable success and who are fairly medically stable can be restored to a minimum weight range agreed upon by the team and then held there for a few months. This can let the psychological work catch up with the body, and then further weight restoration can be done when ready. What is very important is that providers not align with the eating disorder and under-restore patients in the long term. Every patient with anorexia nervosa wants to asymptomatically approach their target weight range. How about 5 pounds less than what you just said? Because they have a mental illness. This serves neither body nor soul well. On the other hand, many patients have experienced true, as opposed to the distortion of the eating disorder or society's view, over restoration at the hands of well-meaning eating disorder programs. This sets up a failure of trust, further anxiety, and often triggers relapses. Physicians can be lulled into complacency by so-called normal weights because we carry our own internal biases, including size and weight stigma. On the other hand, patients can be dangerously involved in their eating disorders and yet appear to be a normal weight. This can lead them to be missed by the medical system. On the other hand, individuals in medical settings can be cautioned about a higher body weight when the measurement is not impacting their health in any way, exposing them to the risks of dieting and weighing cycle and weight cycle that may well have negative impact on their health. We must always resist our own learned sizes tendencies and continue to see the whole person in assessing their medical status. Case resolution, Taylor. Taylor starts seeing her therapist and dietitian once a week and her doctor every 2 to 4 weeks. She works with her dietitian to create a meal plan that starts at 1600 calories a day and increases by 500 calories a week for a target meal plan that meets her body's daily needs. They incorporate foods that Taylor accepts, as well as a number of foods that she has avoided completely for months. She processes these fears with her therapist and learns from her dietitian about the science of metabolism and food reintroduction. Her doctor reassures her from their first session that her metabolism is in no means ruined. The doctor validates how Taylor's survival genetics have protected her from weight loss despite having engaged in such restrictive behaviors, and she identifies that the diagnosis is atypical anorexia nervosa, clarifying that in fact there's nothing atypical about it at all. The approach will be a weight-inclusive one. That is, once Taylor is consuming enough calories to meet her body's needs, her weight may fall, stay the same, or rise, and this number will not be a primary focus. In that first session, her doctor also reviews the medical risks of nutritional rehabilitation and how they will optimize the experience for health and comfort. She starts Taylor on over-the-counter thiamine 200 milligrams a day for the first 10 days of refeeding, as well as recommending zinc gluconate lodges 15 milligrams a day for 1 or 2 months. After 2 weeks, Taylor has started to struggle with fullness as the meal plan increases. Her doctor prescribes metoclopramide for gastroparesis. After a week or two of sleepiness on this medication, Taylor feels much better. She begins taking a dose of polyethylene glycol daily for constipation, which helps too. Taylor uses a mobile application with her dietitian to track what she's eating and how she feels about it. This gives her a sense of accountability to the process, and she is diligent in completing 100% of her meal plan, even through the fear. She promises to stay off her scale. 3 weeks into the process, Taylor is plagued by fears that she's gained 10 pounds and is struggling severely with body image. Her doctor uses this opportunity to give her the objective feedback that she has, in fact, maintained her body weight. The team reassures her, because they know she's completing her calories, that this is because her metabolism is now so fast. Taylor learns how much her body image distortions are truly a part of her mental illness and her internalized size stigma, and how little they have to do with her actual body. A few weeks into nutritional rehabilitation, Taylor's team permits her to start engaging again in mindful, joyful movement, starting with 1 or 2 days a week and doing a little more each week, with days for rest. Taylor does yoga and goes hiking, both activities she finds enjoyable and grounding. She starts regarding her body as being strong and able to take her on fun adventures, rather than being something to tame and dislike. Taylor's relationships with her classmates, family, and friends warm back up. As her brain becomes nourished, she can feel her cognitive function improve. Studying is much faster and easier. She's sleeping better, and she loves the uncomfortable, edgy, anxious feeling she used to experience. She loses the uncomfortable, edgy, anxious feeling she used to experience. 4 months after the intervention by her family and friends, Taylor is in a much better place. She looks forward to the day where she can simply intuit what she needs to eat and when, but she's not quite there emotionally. She still sees her dietitian and therapist weekly. In important ways, her work with her therapist now really takes off because her brain is restored and ready to do the work needed to prevent another relapse in the future. She ha still has hard days, but she's able to recognize the eating disorder voice without acting on it. The balloon metaphor and fear foods. When patients begin the nutritional rehabilitation process, they can experience a lot of GI distress. This physical symptom, whether it appears as bloating and distension, fullness, nausea, constipation, diarrhea, or some combination of these, can be easily misinterpreted by the eating disorder. It can hasten to say, "See, I told you this wasn't safe. We have to go back to what we were doing before." This is particularly true since many people with anorexia nervosa are highly focused on and experience body image distortions around the appearance of their stomach. When patients become underweight or have lost weight very quickly, many have the triggering experience of seeing their most recent meal because their stomachs stick out. Their eating disorder brain can interpret this as weight gain and then try to sabotage recovery work. I like to tell the story of the balloon metaphor in this situation. I tell my patient, imagine I blow up a balloon and tie it off, and I put it on the table in front of you. If I drape a thin sheet over the balloon, you will see every contour. If I toss a thick horse blanket over it, you might see that something's there, but it would be less evident. For the first time in a while, you currently have digesting food, stool, and gas at various stages through your digestive system. These are the metaphorical air blowing up the balloon of your GI tract. Because you have insufficient fat and muscle, your abdominal wall is lying like a thin sheet over that balloon. Your muscles literally aren't strong enough anymore to hold in the contents of your abdomen. Therefore, you can see every meal. By contrast, I have a nice horse blanket, plenty of fat and muscle. As a result, pretty much no matter what I eat, my belly looks the same. I encourage you to reframe and understand that only people who are malnourished and underweight can see their meal. As you get stronger and more weight restored, this will resolve. For now, understand that this protuberant stomach is a sign of malnutrition, the opposite of what you are fearing. Toward the end of nutritional rehabilitation, another belly-related finding is that patients often feel proportionately thicker around the middle than they were before they became ill, even if their weight is within an appropriate range. Everyone is built differently. Some patients who first became ill during adolescence not only need to recover from their anorexia nervosa, but also then need to go through adolescence, even in their 20s or 30s. In particular for females, feminization occurs with development of curves and an adult body habituates that may or may not be welcome. In addition to the redevelopment of an adult body, patients may yet further gain more weight in their abdomen. This is completely normal. Mother Nature's nutritional rainy day fund is stored centrally. After a long famine, the cave person brain will deliberately keep some fat stores there in case the person goes through another famine right away. However, within a year of maintaining an appropriate weight, this will redistribute according to the genetic blueprint of what the person's adult body and size was always going to look like. This brings us to fear foods. Virtually all patients with eating disorders have a set of foods that are off limits, often called fear foods. I have had countless patients react in shock when I support the meal plan their dietitian has laid out for them. But Dr. G, there are processed foods, dairy, wheat, fat, sugars in this meal plan. Everyone knows those are bad for you, cause cancer, trigger inflammation, will make me gain too much weight. First, I let my patients know I walk the talk. I eat everything and restrict nothing. Second, I like to ask them, what if I created a meal plan for you that was virtually guaranteed to cause the following issues? Bloating, fullness, nausea, constipation, hair loss, wrinkled skin, fragile bones, a slowed metabolism, anxiety, social isolation, and cardiac damage. They sense what's coming. I tell them, that's the meal plan you're following presently, the one that your eating disorder has told you is so safe. Nothing is more dangerous for you than restriction. By contrast, I reminded them everything that their dietitian has recommended is vastly more healthful and scientifically safer. That concludes the reading of Sikkhi Nath, Chapter 6.